You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for downloading. As always, it's much appreciated. Now, this week, Scott's not joining me. There's a reason for that. It's because we've got an interview with Hugh Thornbury. Now, he is the Chief Executive Officer for Adoption UK, and he's coming to the end of a five-year tenure, and thought it'd be really interesting to chat to him about some of the things that he's seen over the last 5 years, the state of adoption when he started. So we have quite a broad-ranging discussion about a whole host of things. What we'll do is we'll finish it off next week, and we shall return to Banterama with Scott, and we shall have a bit of a roundup of news and things that are going on with him then. So, as always, if you find it interesting, amusing, and mildly entertaining, then please share widely. Go over to iTunes and give us a review. Favourable ones only, of course. And I hope you enjoy the podcast. So, Hugh, thank you very much for agreeing to speak to me. That was really generous of you at the end of your tenure.
Oh, that's great. It's a good opportunity.
Well, I hope so. I hope it's all that you want it to be, and perhaps if there's anything you want to say, then I'm more than happy to hear that. But yeah. I have some questions. I put some questions out there, and I was just mentioning to you that there's a few really specific questions about the Adoption Support Fund. So
yeah,
I'm not necessarily wanting to get into them, but how do you think it's going with the Adoption Support Fund? That's an easy question to start with.
I think generally it's going okay. I think it was an important thing in two ways. First thing was that it was a very clear sort of objective manifestation of the fact that government had understood the need for better adoption support.
Yep.
And I'll talk perhaps a bit later about, you know, where we were when I sort of joined the organisation in 2012, because I think a lot's changed since then. So it was a signal, I think, to the adoption community, both professional and adopters themselves, that the government had listened to the fact that adoption support wasn't good enough. And the other bit of that then was that by creating a national fund, I think it recognised, and the other bit of that was that by putting central government funding in, which it did for that, you know, first year, and then it extended it till 2020, that was an acknowledgement that local authorities weren't just going to be able to meet that need on their own. There needed to be a sort of phased process by which government took on the burden of responsibility for funding to begin with, and then it has to find another way of continuing that in the future. So that's the first thing. I think it was sort of emblematic in a way of a bit of a sort of paradigm shift that occurred in terms of an acknowledgement that there was a need there that could be met. Second thing, then on the practical level, a significant number of families now have benefited from some interventions from the fund. So people are getting something for their children or for themselves that they weren't getting before. There's then a set of issues, isn't there, around about the fact that the fair access limit, as the government describe it as, other people call it a cap.
For calling it a cap recently off them.
And I'll get in trouble again for saying it now. So, but we started with, when I say we, us at Adoption UK and others working with government, wanting to really promote the use of the fund. So there was a lot of effort in trying to get adopters to understand it was there, to get them to come forward for get assessments, to sort of G local authorities up and help them understand what it was all about. So a big sort of promotion, because we were worried that if take-up was low, further funding wouldn't come from the Treasury. And inevitably, it sort of takes a bit of a while to get going. It then gets going, and then we find last year we're going to run out of money.
People's questions are often around, it is such a patchwork that if you live in, you know, Yorkshire, everything's going pretty good. If you live somewhere else, then you may get a totally different service. So do you think that's teething trouble, or that's kind of, it's highlighted issues that are historic about around adoption support?
Well, I think it's really clearly highlighted that sort of postcode lottery. And that doesn't just exist in adoption support, and you'll know from your sort of wider work and interest that some local authorities consistently perform very well, and even with reduced resources, manage to do things quite well. Yeah. Others have struggled for decades, and there's sort of deeply embedded sort of cultural and leadership issues that mean, you know, that they're never good enough, really. And the fund, in a way, has been a mechanism to sort of try and equalise that, but its reliance on the local authority to do the assessment, you know, still, I think, has shown up, hasn't it? If you look at the data, there's some inexplicable variations in terms of what local authorities are using the fund and what aren't, that aren't explained by demography, I don't think, and so on. You know, they're explained by continuing access issues. And I continue to hear individual stories from people about how long they've had to wait for an assessment.
Yeah, I asked the question off the back of a meeting about that, and the difference was stark. And it's, for some people, it's weeks. For some people, it's measured in years, and that is just not acceptable.
Well, it's not acceptable at all because you know, we still have a real weakness in the system that there's no duty to provide following an assessment. There is a very clear duty to carry out an assessment on the post, isn't it? That's been there for 2 years plus now, and people are still struggling to sort of fulfil that duty, and that's just not good enough. And I think one of the things that fund's done is further expose those things, because we had no idea, really. We had no way of measuring what was going on in particularly post-placement adoption support, and now the fund at least gives us a bit of an insight, doesn't it, into where some of the real weaknesses are lying. We're still quite a long way away then from sort of fixing all of that, but we have better intelligence now about where's working reasonably well and where it's not.
We could discuss the fund ad infinitum, and in some ways that's important for a lot of people. It's a huge deal, but in some ways that's the mechanics of what's been a part of your tenure. So you've been at Adoption UK since 2012. I mean, why did you take the job?
Because they offered it to me. Seriously, I've been in the voluntary sector in children's social care since 93. I was in local authorities between sort of 77 and 93. And I decided my future sort of, once I moved away from the local authority setting and really enjoyed working in the charity sector, I thought this is where I'm going to stay. And then I ended up back in my first job in the voluntary sector in an organisation for about 3.5 years. I then went to Action for Children because I really wanted to be working in an environment that allowed me to sort of broaden my experience of a whole range of different sort of services and different needs. Big charity did that. I thought I'd be there for about 3.5-4 years and then move on, and I was there 15 years, which surprised me, but I had a fantastic, you know, period of time there. I did a whole lot of interesting things. Then got to the point where I thought, I either stay here at Action for Children doing the same thing until I retire, or I go and seek a new challenge, and that challenge would be being a chief executive in a smaller children's charity. And at the time I was looking around, the Adoption UK job came up. I'd already done some policy work with the Tories when they were in opposition from a sort of 2008 onwards, when they began to sort of develop, you know, their sort of manifesto for adoption reform, which they then were able to deliver from 2011. So it's been quite a good fit, really. And I think the fit thing when you're going for chief executive jobs is really important. You've got to feel that it's an organisation with a culture and a sort of, you know, all the trustees that you're going to be able to work with, because that's really important. And they've got to feel that they've got a chief executive that, you know, meets their aspirations to you know, what they're looking for.
Can I ask you a little bit about that? Because you've described that, and it sounds like, in retrospect, you can join the dots and find yourself where you are. But did you do yourself a disservice as you described yourself almost as a career social, you know, was this your career pinnacle, or was it, you know, where's the passion? Is, you know, you've described a career, not a passion, and that's not the youth.
Right. You know. No, well, the passion has been there from, I didn't know I was going to end up in this career. I ended up in it completely by accident. But what I knew quite early on, and I sort of did this at school, was that I enjoyed sort of supporting and mentoring or encouraging children younger than myself to sort of do things. I initially did that by being a member of the climbing club at school and, you know, learning how to rock climb myself and then passing on my skills to younger ones. And I enjoyed that passing on of skills, seeing people develop. I was a parent at a relatively early age. I really wanted to be a parent. That was really important to me. So I've got two daughters. I now have two stepdaughters. So I've always had an interest in the development of young people. And then I fell into working with young offenders completely by accident in my hometown. This was in the mid-70s in Wolverhampton. And I still remember the first time I ever went out with a group of kids in a minibus. And we drove from Wolverhampton up to just north of Leek in the sort of southern fringes of the Peak District to take them out climbing. And here was a group of kids that I hadn't sort of really come across before.
Yes.
That traditional sort of, you know, comfortable middle class upbringing and so on. And boy, were they a handful. One of the first things I had to do was sort of separate some of them, punching the living daylights out of each other in the minibus when we stopped at our sort of arrival point. But there was a sort of an energy to them and a hue to them. And they were just such strong personalities.
Yeah.
And they were in such a desperate place, really, in terms of, you know, the community that they were growing up in, the intergenerational, even back at that time, sort of issues of deprivation, unemployment and all the rest of it. They'd kicked out of school, they'd been banned from the youth club, they weren't allowed to go into local shops and things like that. And I got involved in working with kids like that initially on a sort of part-time basis. Then an opportunity came up to do it full-time with the Social Services Department in Wolverhampton.
So that's the seed of where you started, isn't it?
It is. And that's the thread that's gone all the way through. So I've done different things. So I've ended up at the end of my career, you know, running an adoption charity. But I've done a whole range of other things. And I started off in youth justice. So I started off in a specialism. I've ended up in a specialism.
Yeah.
But I've done a broad range of other things. And the thing that is being central to all of that has been the sort of political view of the world.
Right.
First line manager in social work was a Marxist, member of the British Marxist Party. I got very involved in trade union activity when I was working for the local authority. So I had my eyes open to the sort of injustices within the world and how people, no matter how good or talented they were never getting anywhere. So that's what I saw with working with these kids. There were some very bright kids who, had they grown up in a different environment, you know, would have been doing really well. Yeah, and their lives are just written off, you know, before the time they sort of started secondary school.
That's really interesting because I think that makes sense of, you know, someone who's interested in children. Why do you become a charity leader? Because you're very, very much removed. But that put those holding those two things in tension has led you to where you are, basically.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, and relatively quickly I went into a managerial role. And actually, I sort of enjoyed that. And so for the great majority of my career, I've been in some sort of leadership position or other, initially as a sort of team manager at a relatively early age, and then through to a sort of a chief executive now. And the thing, my passion and my motivation remains the same. I've just found different ways in my career of being able to try and make a difference. And I guess as my career has gone on, the thing I'm most interested in is trying to find a way of changing things systemically for the better in a way that is enduring. And I think that's pretty difficult because we work in a political environment where, you know, policy on children and so on can sort of swing backwards and forwards like a pendulum, depending on who's on power, who's in power. I'm really interested in those things that can make an enduring difference. So one of the things...
Sorry to rein you in, because otherwise we'll turn into Desert Island Discs. What is your first track on the island?
Walk on the Wild Side, Lou Reed.
Excellent. Well done, 7 out of 10. So that led you to a position where you took this job.
Yeah.
That passion, that interest, the leading with the Tories. So, 2012, where was adoption? What did you find and what did you think you needed to do?
What I found was that the government's focus was on reducing delay trying to bring in more adopters because we had over 6,000 children waiting. And the delay in the system was dreadful and harmful for children. We can see that. Judy Selwyn's evidence has demonstrated that, you know, research has demonstrated that clearly there's delay creates difficulties for children later on. And the fact that, that the system wasn't working in any joined up way. So people were coming forward wanting to adopt. Local authorities were turning them away because they didn't sort of match their narrow criteria of who they thought should be adopting. And the children continued to wait there with placement orders and no placements. So I think that was all fine. When I joined Adoption UK, what was absolutely clear was that adoption support was the big issue that wasn't being talked about at all. And when I joined, we just published a report called It Takes a Village. That was a report of a survey of our members identifying, you know, what the state of play was in relation to adoption support. And it was impossible to begin with to get the government or Martin Nery's adoption czar at the time to acknowledge that adoption support was an issue. And Adoption UK was publicly criticised for talking about the difficulties some families were experiencing and the need for better support, because that was seen as being counter to the government's reform programme about encouraging more people to adopt. Yeah, so it was like sort of, it's a very polarised thing, you know. The only way you were going to get more people to come in and adopt children was to paint, you know, a very rosy picture of adoption. If you dared say anything that was sort of contrary to that, you know, you were offside. But we managed to change that, and I think by...
Do you think that I mean, my perception is that's changed, but do you think that is a genuinely held belief within the powers that be that things aren't all rosy and we need to support? Or is it just lip service?
It depends which powers that be, what you're talking about. So I think we have a minister that completely understands that. I think we've had different secretaries of state for education. I mean, we've had the children's minister being fairly consistent. I think there seems to be less interest now held by the current Secretary of State in relation to this than previously. But I think certainly within the Department for Education, I think within NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, I think in some parts of the Department of Health, there's a really sort of clear acknowledgement of that. And I don't think that can be turned back. I think we've gone too far in terms of the things that government have been doing to turn that back. The big challenge is at the implementation level.
Yeah.
And it's only 2 years ago, less than 2 years ago, I was speaking at a relatively small conference for adoption professionals in London, and somebody at the back who was an experienced adoption manager in a London borough asked me, you know, why are we talking about support for children post-placement? Isn't that the family's job? And that really shocked me. I wasn't surprised to hear that sort of 4 years ago. To hear it a couple of years ago made me think I've been making some assumptions here about how the sort of everybody's been on the...
We're all coming together with on this journey.
Yeah. So I think it's... But I think, you know, there's a deepening and developing understanding, I think, within the social work profession. Various things happening, I think, that help the social work profession understand permanence issues better. I think health and education are still massive, massive challenges.
Yeah. There's a way to go. I do have some easy questions for you from Scott. Scott would wants to know if he can have your favourite cup when you leave.
I haven't got a favourite cup. That's just he's making things up.
Yeah. Right, he said you'd say that, but he says you know which one he means. I'm joking, just being facetious. So what's your second track on the island?
Hey Ya by Andre 3000.
It's like you're speaking a different language to me now.
Good, yeah. You want to get down with the kids, mate.
I'm so street. In some ways, your remit has been around the mechanics of adoption. What about the ethics of adoption? Is that something that's just outside of your remit and you've not even gone there?
No, it's not at all. And I wrote something, it didn't get a huge amount of coverage, but about 12 months ago, maybe a bit less than that, I wrote something which was a response to an article by a number of sort of academics in the children's social care sort of adoption permanence world, who were being highly critical of our approach to adopting children without birth parents' consent.
Yeah,
and
in the language, you're being careful with your language, aren't you, when you say that. You're smiling.
How am I careful with my language? Well, what words am I using?
Well, increasingly, I'm seeing the phrase forced adoption.
Yeah, well, I mean, forced adoption, and I've not been in Adoption UK very long, so it's just under 4.5 years. Forced adoption was a term that was only being used by, in my experience, by those who had actually lost their children to the care system and then to adoption. And those individuals would feel that they've been treated really badly, you know, their children have been taken away wrongly and all the rest of it. I've got no way of judging on individual cases. It then started being used by people in the legal profession. It's been started to being used by some professionals and some journalists. Yeah. And I think it's a particularly unhelpful term, and I challenge people when I hear them using it, particularly professionals, because I think they should know better, because the very notion of forced adoption suggests that what we've decided to do, for whatever reason, is to increase the number of children to be adopted, partly to sort of pander to those who can't have children by other means, and therefore we take all children into care so we can feed an adoption system. And that's not, I mean, I just don't believe that is the case at all. There's an issue about the threshold for care, and I think these things get conflated. So there's an issue about the fact that we've got a rising care population, and people will have different views on whether that's a good thing or not. The ethics of this is that we have to make decisions in the best interest of individual children, but we also know then there's a policy, political context those decisions are made. Yes. So New Labour invested a huge amount in trying to keep families together. Michael Gove was very clear about the fact that we were leaving children in too risky situations and we should be bringing children into care more quickly. And if you look back over decades, that sort of threshold of care and it also rises and falls, doesn't it?
It depends what's on the headlines that day, doesn't it? Social workers read the headlines, then go into work and make decisions.
And then what we've got, you know, is the decision-making process in local authorities in courts that decide if a child can't go back home, what's going to happen to them. A minority of children leave care every year to go into adoption. And many of those, it's without the birth parent's consent. So one set of issues about, do we bring children into care too quickly? Should we be doing more to support birth families? I think that's an ethical and a political issue, but it's also an issue that's very much affected by the amount of money local authorities have to support birth families. And there's another issue then about, should we be adopting children without birth family consent. My position on that is, I think if we didn't do that for some children, I think that is the majority of adopted from care, what would be happening to those children?
Yeah.
I think they'd be bouncing, many of them, because of the needs and the challenges they pose for any carer or parent. They would be the kids who would be just bouncing around the care system, moving from placement to placement to placement. Many of these kids have loads of placements before they come, they're adopted, you know that. And who else would be providing the sort of stickability of parenting and resilience?
Because I think that foster care, as long as in long-term foster care, is a hamstrung by the system. It's very binary, isn't it? It's such a binary system. There's adoption, then there's long-term foster care, and there's a gulf in between that has tried to be filled by different things, you know, the SGOs and stuff, but
yeah,
it's case by case basis, isn't it? It has to be. It's tricky.
Well, I think you need a range of responses. I think comparing us to other countries is unhelpful at times, because other countries have a whole different approach to their care systems. You know, so some of those countries that might have very low adoption rates will have very high rates of children being in institutionalised residential care. Yeah. You know. what's the ethics of that? You know, so I think you have to see it in the context of
an issue from another country. Can you? You've got to see the
what we have. No, I think there's a very interesting article in the Guardian yesterday. Reporter got a speech by Lord Justice McFarlane, who I think raised some really, really interesting. And he raised the right questions, I think, in relation to how do we manage, particularly in a sort of digital age, social media. How do we manage adopting children, particularly without birth parents' consent, in a world where everybody can find everybody and communicate with everybody so much more easily? And there's a set of issues, isn't there, for children around how one manages their sort of continuity of relationships with key people within their lives. And when Adoption UK was involved in a care inquiry, one of the report that came out of the care inquiry, us and eight other charities, was called Making Not Breaking. And that came from what one young person said in their evidence inquiry, which was about the fact that they understood why they couldn't be with their birth mum and dad. Yeah. They understood why they'd moved on through sort of different foster placements. What they couldn't understand was why a previous set of relationships to the one that they were in now was almost denied as being of value. So why can't I see my old foster carers now I've been adopted? Or why can't I have more contact with my birth parents? Or I understand I can't live with them and so on. And it was a very strong message there about the fact that children can be helped to understand what's happened to them, why various decisions are made. What they find very difficult is a sort of complete severing of relationships. That may or may not have been particularly fruitful for them, but nonetheless, they were relationships.
Still significant.
It's still significant, and always will be.
Mm-hmm. That is really interesting. That, and I think, why do you think that is? Do you think that's dogma of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, even when I first adopted, that you draw a line in over the past because that's psychologically the best thing, and that's how you know that stiff upper lip. This is your new life. Come on, chop chop, get on with it. Is that it, or is it just?
I think it's partly that. I think there's an outdated notion. I think influenced by sort of a misunderstanding of the research around attachment that, you know, if a child was going to attach to their new carer or parent, the only way they would effectively do that was sort of, you know, remove, almost, you know, sort of erase.
There's a lot of previous attachment, isn't there?
Well, completely. And, you know, as everybody knows, I don't have my own personal sort of experience of adoption. I do have experience of being a stepfather, and I have experience of my stepdaughters very effectively managing a relationship with a new sort of father in their life, me, and their relationship with their birth father. And, you know, what that doesn't come easily. They've worked hard at that, but they've been helped with that as well. And I think, you know, just because their mum has a relationship with me doesn't mean that you wipe out the fact that they've got a dad and they see their dad and that's brilliant.
Yeah, we underestimate children, don't we, that their capacity to hold different people in different places is they're really robust in that sense. They can slot people into boxes because that's their version of normal, isn't it?
I think so, and it's our job as parents, isn't it, or professionals in some cases, to help children to be able to develop the resilience to do with that. Because some will be more resilient than others in their ability to do that, but unless you help them do that, that's always going to be a difficulty for them. It's going to be a difficulty for them in terms of sometimes the tug of sort of past relationships and you know how they feel about that. But it's also going to be an issue for future relationships. You know, we all have to find a way of managing relationships through our lives that aren't straightforward. You know, that's part of.
There is no normal, is there?
No, and increasingly so. I think you know the sort of increasingly people are having to manage complex relationships in their lives.
Yeah. I mean, I guess. It's a slightly off topic, but because I think Adoption UK's remit is supporting adopters, isn't it? Adoption UK is not promoting adoption; it's promoting it's got members. And so, do you find that some of the conversations we're having there are slightly outside of the remit of Adoption UK or your core brief? that's the right phrase?
I don't think so. I mean, I think one of the things I've been able to bring to Adoption UK because of my background and experience is a broader perspective, because I've not spent all my career with adoption. And I think that's really important. And I see our members having that broader perspective. Yes. So there are certain things that as a membership organisation, our members would expect us to do. Yeah. And we'll, continue to sort of bang away about duty to provide, better post-placement support, et cetera, et cetera. But when I talk to adopters about broader issues, they are as passionate about ensuring that sort of children in with long-term foster care or special guardianship arrangements are getting the right support. You know, I don't have a membership that expect me to so narrowly only talk about adoption and then sort of naively, forget there's another world out there. And the important thing here is about children and children finding the right form of permanence that's going to do the right job for them.
I mean, I am intrigued as to know why you're resigning when you're clearly so bothered. Not resigning.
Bothered.
What are you going to do with yourself?
People keep asking me that question. There's a light bulb upstairs I need to change, and my shower started leaking. So that's two things I'm going to be doing in the first week of April.
So that was the first half of the interview with Hugh. And I found him really interesting, and we developed some of those themes, and we got into some more ethical questions as we developed the conversation. Now, I'm going to put the interview out in about a week's time, and I hope that you can find the time to download it. And in the meantime, I hope that you have a fantastic week.